Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the fate of the Supreme Court and President Trump's taxes. Today, Amy Coney Barrett meets with GOP senators as the party pushes forward with the confirmation process ahead of the November election. Also, the New York Times releases a report showing a very low tax bill for the president. Tonight, Donald Trump and Joe Biden meet for the first time on the debate stage, with the Supreme Court vacancy looming large over the race for president. Ruth Marcus is the Washington Post deputy editorial page editor and author of the book Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. I talked with her Tuesday morning about the political fight ahead, Trump's taxes, and how a Coney Barrett confirmation would change the court. Ruth Marcus, before we begin talking about President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, I'd like to ask your reactions to the New York Times report on Donald Trump's taxes.
I thought the Times report, and they've done just an extraordinary job for a number of years now in illuminating the secrecy and actually helping us understand why the president has been so desperate not to release his tax returns. And I thought this latest report was important for two reasons. The first is the news, which we had a glimpse of before, of how little the president, compared to the rest of us, has actually paid in income taxes over the last number of years. I mean, $750, I think you and I would be thrilled to have a tax bill of some small multiple of that. And we don't, I would suggest. And along with that, the aggressive and really offensive use of the tax code to reduce his taxable income, the payments to the hairdresser and the deduction for that. I suspect, Diane, that you and I might spend some money on our own maintenance and indeed on our own hair, but I don't deduct mine, though I would surely like to be able to, and I do need to be presentable for public purposes or as presentable as I can be. And his use of deductions, for example, to funnel additional money to his daughter, Ivanka, which is a way of both getting an additional deduction and reducing his potential estate so he can transfer money to her, not just tax-free, but actually subsidized by the taxpayers. So the aggressive use of deductions and the outrageous bottom line of that is one aspect of the importance of this story. But another aspect of the importance of the story has to do with the risks that we face as a country with a president with this financial profile. According to the Times, and this was the most revelatory piece of the new information, the president has liabilities coming due in the hundreds of millions of dollars. We are not clear to whom those liabilities are owed. And this presents two problems in itself. It presents the risk that the people to whom he owes these liabilities have some kind of leverage over him, and we don't know who they are, so we don't know what that is. And the second is that he has an incentive to use or misuse the levers of government in order to shore up what seems to be his extremely rocky financial footing. And so all these stories about money directed to various Trump hotels, money directed to Trump golf courses while Secret Service and others are staying there, this gives us the motive. We know why it is so important to the president that his properties be shored up. It's that he is in desperate financial straits. And this doesn't just create a problem for Donald Trump. It doesn't just create a problem for American taxpayers in terms of the risk that they're being ripped off, but it really creates a national security problem. And I don't think that's overstating the situation.
What question on the real estate part of those taxes owed? I've talked with a number of people who've said that the loopholes in real estate taxes are really so wide open that you could throw a building through them.
Or several buildings.
Or several buildings. So the question becomes, how much is he simply taking advantage of those tax loopholes? And how much of these tax deductions can be deemed legitimate?
Your question evokes a third scandal here, which is a very Mike Kinsley scandal, which is that the problem isn't what's illegal, the problem is what's legal. And so we do have a tax code that is very filled with loopholes, and that in particular is filled with loopholes that provide enormous benefits for people in the real estate business. So that is a problem that goes beyond Donald Trump. And I personally would not fault Donald Trump to the extent that his reduction in tax liability is a reflection of using, let's call them, pre-existing loopholes that anybody in his situation would be entitled to. And I wouldn't even fault him if he were using those loopholes in a particularly aggressive manner. But what we've seen with his tax returns over the years that they've been reported on, to the extent that we've been able to report on them, thanks in significant part to the New York Times. And if you know how many years I've worked at the Washington Post, you know it's a little hard for me to give this much credit to the New York Times, but they deserve it in this case. What Trump has done is to take the losses on his real estate properties and estimate them to the max at the very same time that he's taken the value of those properties and inflate those to the max when that benefits him in terms of getting loans and things like that. So if part of this tax story is an indictment of the larger tax system, so be it. But I think we've seen enough to understand that it's not simply one more real estate developer, and this one happening to be president of the United States, who's taking advantage of the loopholes in the tax code. It's beyond aggressive tax behavior that goes beyond the normal tax avoidance strategies that are legitimate for all of us. We should all pay what we owe in taxes. We shouldn't necessarily pay more. I don't want to pay more than what I owe.
Final question on taxes. How much of a difference do you think that's going to make to undecided voters on November 3rd?
There is a pretty small slice of undecided voters. There are those folks who could not be, nothing could be done to make us vote for Donald Trump. And there is a significant slice of voters, probably smaller from all the polls, who nothing could be done to shake them from voting for Donald Trump. But to the extent there is this undecided vote, and to the extent that that undecided vote is less than college educated white men in swing states or suburban women who are already a little bit anxious about Trump, I think that the fundamental suggestion that Trump is turning all of us into chumps, the rest of us don't pay $750 in federal income taxes. The rest of us pay a lot more. The firefighters pay a lot more. The school teachers pay a lot more. They pay a lot more as a share of their income and in actual terms. To the extent that this shakes people's confidence in Trump as a businessman and in Trump as somebody who is going to drain the swamp and in Trump as somebody who is looking out for their interests, I think marginal effect, but very marginal because the universe is so small.
All right, let's turn now to the Supreme Court and the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, leaving that extraordinarily poignant and relevant note asking that her replacement not be named until after the election. And now it would seem that Republicans, the president, has not only named her successor, Amy Coney Barrett, but that Republicans are determined to ram this through as quickly as possible. Tell us why you believe that's not a good idea, both in terms of her outlook, her judicial temperament, her background, but also why you believe that may not be fair to the American people.
So I do think that this change on the court to go from a Justice Ginsburg to a Justice Barrett, still getting used to saying that, but I think we'd all better get used to saying that, is really one of the most momentous changes in outlook and composition on the court. And it's one that I don't think in my own personal politics and my own personal jurisprudence is a healthy development for the court. It really locks in for most likely many years to come a solid six-justice conservative majority. And we've seen in the last couple terms, even with the addition of Justice Kavanaugh, how tenuous that majority can be at certain times. Once you get to six, you've got a spare vote and you can really do, from my point of view, a lot of damage. And this is a bigger change, by the way, than we've seen on the court in decades. The last change of this magnitude in terms of shifting ideology on the court was actually when Justice Marshall retired and was replaced by Justice Clarence Thomas, who's still there. This is 1991, so it's been a long, long time. But even if you weren't concerned about where the court is coming out in terms of its liberal-conservative split, you should think, I believe, that this is a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea for the country because it is just splitting us apart. Look at the number of people, the really solid, significant majorities who have said they do not believe that this vacancy should be filled, and yet the Republican Senate and the Republican president are insisting on barreling ahead. So it's very divisive for the country at an already divisive time, number one.
And just to clarify, that majority of people are saying that this president now, before the election, should not be filling that seat.
And their instinct is right. It is too close to the election. This is so different from the argument about whether Judge Garland should have had a hearing, which he should have had when the vacancy occurred in February of an election year, and he was nominated in March of an election year, and that was deemed to be too close to the election because the people should have their say. Now we are just a few weeks from the election. People have already started voting, but they don't get their say about who should make this very momentous change. It's terrible for the Senate. And maybe the answer to this point is that it can't actually get that much worse or that much more divisive. But the Senate was a body that used to be able to operate by consensus. It had rules that required it to operate by consensus, including the filibuster, which I think is likely to be dispensed with if there is a Democratic majority. And that may be a good idea or maybe a bad idea, but by ramming this through, we're just really reducing the capacity of the Senate to come together in a bipartisan way, to the extent it still exists, and achieve important results. And third, maybe most important for me, it's truly bad for the court. Even if you're not worried about the liberal-conservative split, it's bad for the court as an institution. It just makes it look like another partisan institution that is subject to the whims of politics, where people are picked only for their political / ideological proclivities. And it's just another tool in a larger partisan battle. And it opens up the prospect, if not the likelihood, of making significant changes to the court, including changing its size, that I think are going to further throw the court into a political morass and a political maelstrom that's bad for the court. And honestly, what's bad for the court is bad for the country.
Give me a sense of some of her judicial rulings that you believe signify why you are so concerned about her.
So there are two things that I look at. One thing I look at is not her judicial rulings, but her quite extensive and thoughtful academic writings before she joined the bench, of which the most important part is her view of a Latin phrase that we've all become familiar with, stare decisis, and it means to let things stand. And it's a rule that the court applies with differing degrees of force, but it has kept stability in the law and it has kept the court. We saw it operate just this last term when the Chief Justice voted to strike down a law from Louisiana that restricted abortion. He voted to strike down that law, even though just a few years earlier, he had voted to uphold an almost identical law from Texas. And the reason that he did that was stare decisis, that the court can't be seen, in order to maintain its integrity as an institution, to be veering back and forth in a sort of zigzag way based on who's in charge, like it's just the House or the Senate. Justice Barrett's views when she was Professor Barrett on stare decisis were very much in alignment with both Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, who basically believe if it's a constitutional case where the court gets the last say and a justice believes, and she has written this, if a justice believes that the case is wrongly decided, the justice should go with her vision of the Constitution and not just stick with precedent. So if you apply that, as Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas have, and Justice Thomas has been very outspoken on this, you have all sorts of precedents that an originalist judge, and Judge Barrett told us at in the Rose Garden the other day that her philosophy is Justice Scalia's philosophy, which is an originalist philosophy. If that's true and you accept this view of stare decisis, then you see all sorts of precedents start to fall that originalists would argue are wrongly decided. It starts with abortion, but it doesn't stop there.
What comes next?
Well, you could imagine a lot of things. Judge Barrett, soon to be Justice Barrett, has identified seven cases, I believe, that she calls super precedents that won't be reviewed. But they are things like Marbury versus Madison, which instituted the role of the judiciary in reviewing the constitutionality of laws, or cases that are really obscure and wouldn't naturally be challenged about the constitutionality of all things of paper money. Apparently, if you're an originalist, our dollar bills, which I don't use paper money anymore, are not actually constitutional, but nobody's going to really revisit that. But notably, she does not have Roe v. Wade on her list of super precedents. And what I would say is, if you're an originalist judge and you have a view of stare decisis such that you believe that you should apply your best understanding of the original meaning of the Constitution and not worry about whether the court got it wrong in previous cases, all sorts of things could fall. The constitutionality of affirmative action programs, the constitutionality of treating women differently from men as a matter of equal protection. Justice Ginsburg argued that the Equal Protection Clause should provide protection for discrimination on the basis of gender. But if your view is that the original meaning of the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause only goes to race, then you're not going to have different views there. If your view of the Constitution is that it doesn't include a promise of marriage equality and a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, then that could fall. So you just have this potential domino effect across the landscape of constitutional law.
More from Ruth Marcus when we come back. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Ruth Marcus. She's deputy editorial page editor at The Washington Post and author of the book Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. So if she had been on the court in the last term, are there some rulings that could have gone the other way?
I think almost certainly the Louisiana abortion ruling would have gone the other way. The fundamental question of the constitutional status and the continuing viability, pardon the pun, of Roe v. Wade was not before the court then. That's going to have to wait for another case, but it could be coming really quite soon, where if you have some of these laws like a fetal heartbeat law that prohibits abortion after a fetal heartbeat can be detected, that's an absolute 100% conflict with Roe. That would come up. But certainly if we had Justice Barrett last year instead of Justice Ginsburg, I think it's absolutely certain that the Louisiana abortion law would have gone into effect. And just to explain what this is, it's a law that requires that doctors who perform abortions have admitting privileges at local hospitals. There is no indication that that helps keep women healthier or safer. It just makes it harder for abortion clinics to operate. And the practical effect, the record showed, of allowing that law to take effect would have been that there would be one abortion clinic, one doctor actually in Louisiana who could continue to perform abortions. That doesn't wipe out Roe v. Wade, but it has the practical effect of wiping out the right.
What about DACA?
Well, DACA is a really interesting thing because the DACA ruling, where once again the Chief Justice kind of surprised everybody and voted to throw out the Trump administration's effort to undo the DACA protections for Dreamers, people who were brought to this country without documented status as children, but have grown up here as Americans and who, under a program implemented by President Obama, have been allowed to have an ability to stay and to go to school and to work for a period of years while we try to work out a fairer adjudication of their rights. That was a case that didn't involve the Constitution. It involved regulatory interpretation and whether the Trump administration had kind of crossed the I's and dotted the T's in junking the Obama administration's rule. I think it is less absolutely clear that a Justice Barrett, because she has a less lengthy track record on administrative law than on constitutional law, and because one could understand her to be a stickler for the rules. So there's more chance that she would have voted with the Chief Justice to allow DACA to remain in effect. But I wouldn't say that that's a majority chance. If you were a dreamer, you wouldn't say, oh, I'm sleeping really soundly because Justice Barrett's on the court. Notably, while the Chief Justice said that the Trump administration, while it had the right to undo this regulation, just didn't go through the proper procedures to do it. Notably, all the other conservatives on the court voted to allow the regulation to take effect. There's kind of nothing in Judge Barrett's background that suggests she won't go with them. And if I could actually describe one case that she decided that might give you a sense of that. There was a American citizen whose wife is from Yemen, and the wife wanted to get a visa to come to this country, which she, I think, pretty much presumptively entitled to as an American citizen. The consular officer who looked at her visa turned it down and said, you can't come because the evidence shows that you tried to smuggle two children into the United States. And they submitted, according to the court opinion, all sorts of evidence that these were her own children, that these children had drowned in some kind of tragic accident. They submitted the police reports of this drowning, and they asked the court to review the consular officer's determination that no, she couldn't, this woman who had lost her two children could not get a visa to join her American citizen husband in this country. And Judge Barrett, for the majority, wrote a 2-1 majority. I think it was a Republican appointee, I think an appointee of President Reagan, who dissented from this. But Judge Barrett's view was this: the court has said that consular officers' determinations are not subject to review. Don't care if he got it wrong or right. The law says you're out of luck. Done.
Wow.
That's just one case.
What about gun rights?
Gun rights are a really, really up for grabs area of the law. The court, having made a decision some years ago, about a decade ago, that the Second Amendment does protect an individual right to bear arms, has tried to stay away in the years since from making pronouncements about exactly what that right does and does not allow. But Judge Barrett, one of the concerns when she was up for, and I write about this in my book, which I need to plug for one second, Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Boy, now it's Brett Kavanaugh and the really, really conservative takeover. Judge Barrett was on the short list and might have gotten the nod over now Justice Kavanaugh. But one concern was that gun rights groups didn't think she had a clear record on this issue, which she didn't. But now she does. I think it was a dissent in a gun rights case. And I'll just give you briefly the facts of this one. There was a man who was convicted of a felony. And the rule is that felons, after they serve their sentences, are not eligible to own handguns. It was under both state law and federal law, I believe. And Justice Barrett looked at it and said, no, 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 he is not a violent felon. There is no history of depriving gun rights to violent felons. And so he should be allowed to own a gun, because doing otherwise, she says, would consign the Second Amendment to being a second-class right and a second-class amendment. So she is, I think, very clearly going to be among the conservative justices who have been getting increasingly frustrated that the court has not been willing to take on gun cases. And there's all sorts of really, I think, important and reasonable gun restrictions that are at issue here. For example, one is large capacity magazines. If you look at like the tragic shooting of Gabby Giffords, if you had had magazine capacity limits in place, there would have been more opportunity to stop the shooter before he did as much terrible damage as he did to Gabby Giffords and others. And this is true in any number of mass shootings. Open carry laws, concealed carry laws, laws about AR-15s and assault weapons. Justice Kavanaugh said on the appeals court that he thinks that restrictions on owning assault rifles are unconstitutional because they're not consistent with the original sense of understanding at the time of the adoption of the Second Amendment, and because there's not a history of restricting these kind of semi-automatic weapons. I think it's clear from this ruling that she had, which was a dissent, that Justice Barrett would be with the conservatives on that as well.
Some are concerned, and I wonder whether you think rightfully so, that her appointment and her seat on the court would constitute the sixth Roman Catholic on the bench. Now, the question about that is, I gather that Judge Kavanaugh is no longer a Roman Catholic, but an Episcopalian. Am I correct on that?
It's Justice Gorsuch, but I mean, it's really quite remarkable if you look at the history of the court, if you look at the fact that Justice Ginsburg, when she joined the court, was the first Jew to join the court since, I think it was 1969. So that's a pretty long stretch. Now we had, with Justice Ginsburg, we had three Jewish justices. Now we have seven justices who are now or were raised as Catholics. If you leave aside Justice Gorsuch, you get it down to a mere six. I think it's an interesting question about how we should think about that. I am absolutely reluctant to criticize people because of their faith or to think that the predominance of a faith on the court is a kind of automatic problem. I mean, if you look at, we had a court that was, until Justice Ginsburg's death, one-third Jewish. That's way in excess of the number. And just so everybody is very clear as I'm saying this, I am as Jewish as they come. But if you're going to start to worry about too many Catholics on the court, then you would have probably worried about too many Jews on the court, which I did not. But 33% representation is way in excess of the presence of Jews as a matter of the American population. So I'm not going to worry about that. And I'm also going to take Justice Barrett, I think, at her word that she's capable of separating out her religious convictions, which are sincere and deeply held, from her judicial philosophy. I think that there is enough in her record to be concerned about. If you simply accept her faith, that people of faith are welcome on the court, that we don't have religious tests for any office in the United States. And so let's just talk about the legal merits and the lack of wisdom of filling this seat at this moment and leave her religion alone.
So then moving forward, what kinds of questions do you believe Democrats could or should ask that would help people to understand from their perspective the nature of this judicial appointment?
So confirmation hearings, and my experience covering confirmation hearings goes back to the one that was the most revelatory and, you know, probably impactful of them all, which is the Bork hearing, where Judge Bork in 1987 probably lost his ability to be confirmed with testimony that was pretty forthcoming about his view of constitutional interpretation. He said what he thought, and it was really outside the mainstream of American constitutional thought. And that's what a significant majority of the Senate concluded, including, I think it was six Republican senators who voted against him. Since Bork, nominees have been, unsurprisingly, much more guarded and much more careful and much more grudging in what they've been willing to say. And these are both Republicans and Democrats. Justice Kagan famously wrote a book review that criticized the confirmation process as, I think she used the word charade, but when her own confirmation came up, even using those words against her, there was no dislodging her to give answers that she wasn't prepared to give about what she thought about particular areas of the law. And I rewatched some of Judge Barrett's appeals court confirmation hearing the other day, and she is equally adept and quite adept at dodging questions about what she thinks about particular cases and particular areas of the law. Senators are not going to extract a lot of substance from her on that, but I think that Democratic senators can present a record based on her own statements. For example, at the Rose Garden ceremony where she was introduced, and I mentioned this earlier, Judge Barrett said of Justice Scalia, "His philosophy is my philosophy." So if I were a Democratic senator, what I would do is take out a list of Antonin Scalia's greatest hits and say, "You've said, Judge Barrett, that his philosophy is your philosophy." When he dissented in this case and said it was an outrage to give this right, is that your philosophy? She's not going to answer, but you could probably have several senators' rounds of questions based on Scalia's very extensive and provocative views where you could lay out the stakes for people. Is it going to change any votes? No. Is it going to educate people about the stakes of the election? Potentially. And that's, you just have to play the hand you're dealt as well as you can do it.
So the question becomes, is there anything that you believe Democrats can do to postpone her appointment, or has Mitch McConnell so fixed the agenda that she will have these 4 or 5 days of hearings, and then the vote will be taken, and she will take a seat on the court before November 3rd.
I believe that that is what is going to happen, and I have a very, very hard time seeing anything that could change either the outcome or the timing of the outcome. The president has made really clear, and this is another interesting, at least, avenue for questioning, though you're not going to get a great answer on it. The president has made clear that it's really important to him to have a ninth justice to decide any election disputes that might come to the court. They're already there, and there's going to be probably more to come. Totally fair question to ask Justice-to-be Barrett whether she would recuse herself from hearing those cases, because the president has so clearly linked her confirmation to his chances at the court. She's not going to answer. She's going to say, I will abide by the normal rules for recusal, which, by the way, there's no actual rules for recusal for justices. They just follow their own best judgment. My prediction would be very strongly that we will not see her recuse herself in an election case that's before the court. But there's just vanishingly little absent that Democrats can do, absent more Republicans, which we're not going to see because they've already made their positions clear, absent more Republicans peeling away. Mitch McConnell, both in the Kavanaugh hearings and nomination, and now with Judge Barrett, has just done a remarkable job of throwing down the gauntlet early. Either we're not going to have a hearing and a vote, or we're going to have an immediate hearing and a vote. And he has kept those troops, as many of them as he has needed, just firmly in line. And this is going to march through. And I'm very confident that some version of the wrinkle that we saw with Justice Kavanaugh, with last-minute accusations of wrongdoing, is not going to arise with Judge Barrett. As far as I can tell, I was just speaking to somebody last night who knows her, and she just seems to be extraordinarily well-liked, not just by conservatives, but by liberals that she's clerked with, that she's worked with in law practice, that she's worked with in academia. She seems like a very decent person. And I know I'm riling. I can hear listeners being riled up as I say this. But my point is, I don't think there's a smoking Amy Barrett gun out there. I think she's going to be Justice Barrett, and we need to just resign ourselves to that.
Back, however, to the undecideds. To what extent do you believe that Trump's push to move forward with this nomination as quickly as he did after Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death could affect that small percentage of undecideds?
It affects two different audiences. It affects evangelical base in the Republican Party that's going to be very, very excited about the sixth conservative vote. And this may be a little bit the triumph of hope over experience, because the experience is that the Supreme Court, which I think is so important and should be such an important factor in people's voting decisions, has not been a motivating force for Democratic voters. I do think that that could be different this time around. I think we've never seen a reaction to a vacancy like this. We've never seen a reaction to the death of a justice like this. I think that to the extent that some of the up for grabs voters are suburban women who are supportive of abortion rights, suburban women who think that, along with the rest of the majority, that it's just unwise and unfair to fill this seat so close to the election. I think that this could be a net plus, even weighing on the other side those excited evangelicals. It could be a net plus for Biden, but a pretty small plus.
A small plus.
Which is better than a minus.
And finally, an opinion piece written by the head of the ACLU, David Cole, recently wrote that courts rarely go full throttle against public opinion. To what extent do you share that idea?
I solicited that piece for the Washington Post op-ed page. So, and he did his usual very good and smart job. And so I really commend it to everybody who's listening. I do think that the court has been reluctant as an institutional matter. I always talk about it as having a kind of internal gyroscope. It doesn't want to tilt too far in one direction or the other, and it doesn't want to tilt too far away from where people are. But one of the reasons that we have that gyroscope built into the court is that over time, the composition of the court is shaped by Democratic presidents and Republican presidents, or the composition of the court has not been as partisanly focused, and nominations have not had as much of a partisan focus as they have in, say, the last three decades. But even with that, Democratic presidents get theirs, Republican presidents get theirs. It kind of creates a court that's in the middle. And by the way, before we got rid, which was a terrible idea, before we got rid of the filibuster for judges, the requirement that a nominee have 60 votes pushed nominations towards the middle. Now there's no, because all you need is 50 votes, as long as you have vice president to break the tie, or 51 if you don't, now you can nominate somebody as radical as the traffic will bear on either side. So I think that courts have been reluctant to go full throttle is really going to be tested. It's historically true, but the most pressing and important example currently is, what will this court, with a 6-justice conservative majority, 4 of whom I believe voted against marriage equality, I think I'm forgetting, maybe 3, because Justice Gorsuch wasn't on the court, I don't think. In any event, what will this court do with the Obergefell precedent, the case that said the Constitution protects the rights of gays and lesbians to marry? Will it look and say, okay, this case has been actually pretty broadly accepted. People are supportive of the right. It hasn't created the kind of social unrest that Roe created in its aftermath. So should we not disturb it, even if we do think it was wrongly decided? That actually is why Justice Barrett's, soon to be Justice Barrett's, views on stare decisis are so important. If you say, okay, well, the court doesn't want to go full throttle against public opinion, you get to one thing. But if you have the view that the court's job is not to worry about public opinion, the court's job is to worry about what the Constitution says, which, of course, that is its primary job. I don't want to suggest that it's not. You could get a different outcome. And that's why this is so momentous.
Any final thoughts for our listeners, Ruth?
Watch the hearings. Listen as much to the questions as to the answers, because the answers are probably not going to be that illuminating, but hopefully the questions will be. And whatever you think about where the court should be, make it a factor in your vote, because as much as I don't want to see the court as a political football, it really is. It's just been made so by the events of the last several years.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Diane, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you, and it's really nice to see you even over Zoom.
That was Ruth Marcus, columnist and deputy editorial page editor at the Washington Post. She's also author of the book Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you'll stay well, stay safe. I'm Diane Reed.